There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaVerge. This is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversation? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? And how do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind or another opinion piece. But what people do very much need is the very peace of the mind of Christ. And I think you are just the person to give it to them. So I invite you to connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our email newsletter. We'll send you lots of information and commentary we don't have time to share here in the hour on the air, because it may not surprise you, I have more to say than I can get said. Okay, so while you are at the website, I'd really appreciate it if you became a reconnector. Those are our ministry partners who actually financially support us. That would be great. You can also like The Reconnect on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter, at Carmen LaVerge. All right, I know we've said so before, but I have a new book out. It is called Speak the Truth. And if you go to reconnectwithcarmen.com today, you can get a free downloadable chapter. All right, as you know, an incentive to buy the book. That's pretty much what that is. We are hoping that, you know, you get the free downloadable chapter, you read it, and you say to yourself, well, I can't live without reading the rest of this. So there you go. It's available in every format under heaven. Okay, so I'm going to lead off today with joyful news that House Majority Whip Steve Scalise, Republican from Louisiana, has returned today to the House after 106 days of recovery. When he was, but you will recall, he was shot during a baseball practice of Republicans in preparation for a baseball game against the Democrats. Okay, so we have a little audio from that just to celebrate Steve Scalise's return.
When I was laying out on that ball field, the first thing I did once I was down and I couldn't move anymore is I just started to pray. And I will tell you, it gave me an unbelievable sense of calm, knowing that at that point it was in God's hands. But I prayed for very specific things. And I'll tell you, pretty much every one of those prayers was answered. And they were some pretty challenging prayers I was putting in God's hands. But he really did deliver for me and my family. And it just gives you that renewed faith in understanding that the power of prayer is something that you just cannot underestimate.
Okay, friends, so you and I prayed for Steve Scalise, and we were praying with him, and we were praying as brothers and sisters in Christ. And so I think that it's important to remember, I say this all the time, one of the things we've got to do is pray the news and never underestimate the power of doing that. Never underestimate the power that God can bring to bear on a situation. I love the spirit of what Scalise says when he's like, those were some pretty challenging prayers that I was lifting up. Nothing is too big for God. Nothing. Nothing is too big for God. And I am one of those people who would say that even if God had chosen not to deliver Steve Scalise in all the ways that he prayed, God would still be God. God's sovereign will would still be being worked out, and God would be using what happened to Steve Scalise to glorify himself in some way, shape, or form. So we praise and thank God for the deliverance of Steve Scalise from what harm another person intended to do to him. And we continue to pray for a hedge of protection around those who put themselves in willingly in harm's way in order to serve us. One of the things that we talked about following the Scalise shooting was we don't really think about our congressmen and women putting themselves in such a precarious position on our behalf. We just don't think of them as serving in the front lines of the culture war in quite the same way that we think of our military men and women. But they are. They are. They are on the front lines of an ideological battle. And so we need to be praying for God's hedge of protection around them every day. I appreciate that Steve Scalise was willing to bear witness and testimony to his faith and to the goodness of God. So let's hear the second tape.
But that's why I'm so excited to be back, because as we're fighting through the issues of the day, let's just keep in mind that we rise above the challenges of the day and understand that it's not just us and our constituents and the country, the United States, that's counting on us being successful. People all around the world that believe in freedom are counting on us as well, and we will deliver for them. That's why I am so honored to be back here in the House serving with you. God bless each and every one of you, and God bless the United States of America.
There you go, friends. There's your unity appeal for the day. We certainly are praising the Lord our God, not only for Steve Scalise and for other members of the House and certainly members of the Senate. We're actually praising God for the fact that we live in the United States of America and that we have an opportunity, as Representative Scalise just articulated, not only to to bear the torch of freedom here in the United States, but to actually bear it as a light lifted up to others, a light of hope. There are people around the world who are literally praying today for the kinds of freedoms that you and I already enjoy. And so let's be mindful of that, even as we thank God for the United States of America in which we live. Let her be a shining light of blessing and freedom and hope to others. Okay, making a transition here to a show that is going to return to network television tonight. The show is Will and Grace. Now, some of you are hearing that and you're saying, oh, I remember that show. Others of you are saying, oh, I remember that show. I think that it's fair to say that in the seasons in which it ran, and it actually went off the air like 11 years ago. I think that's about right. Let's see. 11 years after the show came to an end, it's coming back with 29 new episodes, and then they've already signed for a second season. So 11 years ago, the long-running situational comedy Will and Grace came to an end. This is a show that had more culture-transforming impact and has moved the needle on the issue of the acceptance of the gay lifestyle than pretty much anything else that you could point to in terms of where we are today. I think that the problem, and you will see this if you read the reviews of the show, certainly from the mainstream media and the more leftist press, you're certainly going to see our open condemnation in advance of the show coming back, that it's viewed as, privileged, white, misogynistic. Let's just go down the list of things that are not good about Will and Grace. And the characters, which might have been cutting edge 20 years ago, neither the characters nor the content are particularly cutting edge today. Well, why is that? Because the needle has moved so far in the culture. And so when Will and Grace came on the air, suffice it to say, the names of the characters are intentionally chosen. It is supposed to be theological. It is supposed to bear up against the defenses that you have in terms of your views of sexuality and sexual identity and liberty and those kinds of things. And it was a part of an overarching cultural strategy to move the U.S. culture in the direction of acceptance of same-sex relationships. So it's a part of a plan that was actually laid out in a book called After the Ball. And in that book, Marshall Cook and Hunter Madsen actually prescribed 20 years in advance of media and pop culture campaign. They planned this out. And so decades later, sitcoms, including Will and Grace, but films and all kinds of other media have basically normalized homosexuality in our culture today. We did not get here by accident. We got here because several decades ago, people sat down and laid out a strategy that they have been very adept at accomplishing. And part of that strategy was Will and Grace. All right. So it started about 20 years ago, went off the air 11 years ago. It's going to come back on the air tonight. It will be very interesting to see how Will and Grace this time around is received, because now Will and Grace actually follows shows like Modern Family or Transparent or the reality of people like Bruce Jenner, Caitlyn Jenner. Like we live in a really different world than the one that Will and Grace entered into and sought to transform. President Joe Biden once said of the show Will and Grace that it probably did more to educate the American public on homosexuality than almost anything else, right? So it was an educational tool. I want you to think about that statement, that the then vice president of the United States pointed to this show as culture transforming. It was the first network television show to feature a gay character, and it was a part of the effort to normalize homosexuality in the culture. And it was certainly a part of moving us toward the acceptance of same-sex marriage. And so you say, well, how is that possible? I mean, how is it possible that that a show could be used in that way to actually move the cultural needle? Oh, please. That's what happens all the time. If you're not aware of it, then you're not aware of an entire segment of psychology called parasocial relationships. I don't know if you've ever heard of parasocial relationships, but you and I actually apparently make attachments, which are called parasocial relationships, to people we have never met in real life, in the flesh, but we actually, we think we have friendships. We think we have relationships with. Now, pushed to the extreme, we recognize that people become delusional about these things. Sometimes when individuals fixate on, let's say, a celebrity, and they actually think they have a relationship with that person, we have a name for that, and we categorize that as actually a psychological disorder, and we arrest those people and we put them away. But you and I, across the culture, have these attachments of parasocial relationships, and there's a growing body of research out there that looks at shows like Will and Grace and shows like Black-ish that actually, over the course of time, change our perception. Fresh Prince of Bel-Air is a part of this entire conversation. People actually felt like they were friends with the Will Smith character. I think about that for a minute. Who was your first Black friend? If you're a white person out there, I want you to think about who your first Black friend was. And if you grew up in a white silo of America, Will Smith might have been your first Black friend, because he was cool. And he was accessible, and you liked him, and he was funny, and he was joyful, and he was entertaining. And he lived in a place that you would very much want to live, and a life that you would very much like to have. So I want you to think about that. Who's your first gay friend? Is your first gay friend a character from the Will and Grace comedy? I want you to think about that for a moment. Is that the first gay person who was in your home, and therefore in your conversations and in your psyche? That's a part of how this works. So there's a guy named Edward, I will probably mispronounce his last name, so I'm just going to give it a shot, Shipa. He's a media studies researcher at MIT. He is the national expert on the subject of attachment parasocial relationships. He's the one who has done the research on shows like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Will and Grace, 6 Feet Under, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. The list goes on and on here. And Black-ish is on the list now in terms of contemporary shows today. He looked into whether shows that predominantly feature particular varieties of people lower the prejudice towards those people over time. And he has proven out that if you watch Will and Grace, they can actually measure the sort of whittling away of any sort of moral resistance that you might have had to same-sex relationships and same-sex marriage. So there you go. Psychologists have actually consistently found the most effective way to rid people of these, what they describe as bigoted ideas. The most effective way to do it is actually put them into interactions and relationships with people from that minority position. So you say, how are we going to get our sorted, you know, America is proven to be sorted out into silos or into groups that are pretty closed. I remember that PRRI told us, I think it was just last year, that that most white Christians in America, you know, they might have one Black friend or one Latino friend or one Asian friend, but overall, 91% of their friends are white. White people have white friends in America. That is how closed our social networks are, our social circles are. And so how do you get different types of people to organically become friends? Well, you put them on television. You put them into, unless you're going to actually throw them into into the mix together in some sort of reality TV setting. The way to do it is to safely invite characters who live other different lifestyles or live other in different ways. How to get them into your home is through your TV. All right. The other way today would be through social networking. And so when you think about Will and Grace, and you think about the phenomenon of Will and Grace, and you think about it returning to the television tonight, I want you to think about whether or not you sort of prepared yourself to engage in that conversation in a way that both honors the truth, but does so in grace, because those are really important. Okay, it occurs to me, as a person who watched Will and Grace back in the day, it occurs to me that the character Grace, played by Deborah Messing, she is portrayed as having grown up in a Christian home. I don't know if you knew that, but she's portrayed as having grown up in a Christian home, but never throughout her upbringing by presumably Christian parents and presumably a Christian church, was she ever equipped to deal with people like Will or Jack, the people she meets later in life, the other characters around whom the show Will and Grace is set. She is nice, she is friendly, and she is totally morally malleable. I think that is essential. It's essential for us to recognize that the one person in this show who supposedly grew up in a Christian home was totally ill-equipped to deal with the realities of people who present as homosexual and the kinds of entanglements that might create for you in terms of your friendship. So, I don't think that very much has probably changed in the interim since the introduction of the show Will and Grace and its reintroduction tonight. I think the reality is that most Christian families and most Christian churches are still not equipping the graces of the world to deal effectively with the Wills and the Jacks. So that's what we're actually trying to do here. We're trying to help you reconnect the eternal with the everyday. We're here to try to help you speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time and to do so in a way that honors Jesus. So this is not in any way seeking to tell you to go out there and be mean to anybody. That's not what this is about. But it is about being truthful and honest about the reality of how God intends things to be. And to be advocates of that, no matter what, no matter how unpopular, and no matter if other realities are being presented in very provocative and very compelling ways on television. Now, it'll be interesting that the pushback that the Will and Grace reinvention is probably likely to get will be more from the left than from the right. Because frankly, Will and Grace is just not going to go far enough to satisfy a culture that has so far surpassed its original ideas. All right, really quickly, the Republican tax plan was unveiled today. It's basically just a framework. The devil is going to certainly be in the details, and we will talk at length about tax reform over the coming days and probably weeks. But I want to talk about Hugh Hefner. I want to get to this subject because I do think that when we're talking about people who have really transformed our culture, programs like Will and Grace are a part of that. But guys like Hugh Hefner, who actually set themselves on a course to change the way Americans and the world think about something very essential and very, very both natural and supernatural as sex, like a person who set his life's course on achieving one thing, to change American attitudes about sex. Well, that he fully achieved, but what did he lose in the meantime? I have an interesting clip of audio from a 1966 interview on Firing Line with William Buckley, where William Buckley engages Hugh Hefner on the moral transition that he is trying to achieve in America.
The implication that, in other words, it'll be a very sad thing indeed if what we get out of this transitional period, because we are going through a period of moral transition related to sex, and we will not be going back to the old concepts. Now, if all we wind up with out of this is a new legalism in which thou shalt or thou must replaces thou shalt not, I agree with you, we'll be no better off. The attempt in establishing something that will be more related truly to what I consider to be really ethical or really moral will be a situation in which people are able to make these decisions situationally, related to the real circumstances and related to people's real interests.
Okay, did you hear all of that? Take note there of what Hugh Hefner is saying. He is saying that he believes that a real ethic or a real morality is situational, and it's based on people being able to make decisions moment by moment situationally. Well, that's fine if your heart and mind and soul are captive to Jesus Christ, and you are actually going to always and in all ways operate out of the mind of Christ on the matters of the day. But if we're just talking about purely doing whatever we want to do in any given situation, we're talking about pure hedonism. And that is basically the ethic that Hugh Hefner was advocating. Friends, that was 1966 when that interview aired with Bill Buckley. And I want to make that available to you. So that's actually an interview that you ought to watch. You ought to listen to. It is educational. First of all, just how much media has changed in the past 50 years, but also how much the sexual revolution has progressed. So Hugh Hefner in 1966 was sort of on the cutting edge. He was actually probably creating the cutting edge of this particular moral revolution. And according to ABC News, when asked what he was most proud of, Hefner actually said he was most proud of changing America's attitude towards sex. Now, that means that up until that point, he thinks we had a flawed understanding of sex. And he thinks he had the right understanding of sex, which was an ethic of mutual consensual sex. If it was mutually consensual, Hefner thought it was fine. Anytime, any place, with anyone. That is just absolutely not God's definition of sex, or why God gave the great gift of sex. And so Hefner so misunderstands what marriage is and what sex is and why it is given by God and how good it is. And so I think it's important for us to be sure we know the answers to those questions. So if I were to just ask you, what is sex? If you don't answer, it's the wonderful, great gift of God given to those who are married, male and female, in the context of a monogamous lifelong relationship. Why is sex given? Why is marriage given? Because God actually wants to reveal to us the mystery of Christ and his love for the church. He actually wants us to have the opportunity to experience in the context of this life what we are going to live as a part of the bride of Christ in heaven forever. There is a wedding feast of the Lamb coming, and right now, God is preparing the bride of Christ, the church, those who rely on Christ for their salvation. God is preparing us even now for this eternal relationship with his Son. So it's not, it's an absolute perversion of the gift to say that sex is about our pleasure, that it's about the satisfaction of some kind of appetite, whenever we want it, with whomever we might choose to have it. It's an absolute perversion of what God has given among us to be good. Hey, there are any number of commentators out there who have posted today about Hugh Hefner's life and legacy. If I were going to direct you to one that I think is particularly well said, it would be Ed Stetzer's piece on the Exchange blog. It's entitled Hugh Hefner, Mourning and Legacies Beyond the Pipe and the Robe. Is sex better because of Hugh Hefner? So again, that's Ed Stetzer at the ChristianityToday.com Exchange blog. One of the things that he talks about in there is what is the legacy of Hugh Hefner, and he sums it up this way. The legacy of Hugh Hefner is basically the objectification of women and a culture that is totally now saturated with pornography. And so notably, Hugh Hefner, who claimed to have sex with more than 1,000 women in his lifetime, also said he never found his soulmate. Well, that's because, Mr. Hefner, today you're probably confronting the reality that it does not profit a man to gain the whole world if, in fact, he forfeits his soul. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LeBurge. Check it out online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is The Reconnect. We're here putting God in his place back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. And that means we got to get the eyes of the Father on the world. We got to begin seeing the world as the Father sees it. And then we have to allow the mind of Christ to become our mind. We have to saturate our lives with the very word of God, and we have to be possessed of the Spirit of God in order that we can bring God back into the conversations of the day. So that's what we're talking about. We're trying to talk about what other people are talking about, what we're trying to do so in a way that reconnects the eternal with the everyday so you can be a fully equipped ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. One of the other people who does this on a regular basis, his name is Parker Hudson. You can check him out at parkerhudson.com. Parker is a speaker and an author of several books, including The President, 10 Lies, 10 Truths, Enemy in the Room, and On the Edge. All right, so if you haven't read any of them yet, you have to start with The President, because you will say to yourself, how is it that the guy that wrote this so long ago, and it's totally about today? So anyway, Parker Hudson is a dear friend. You can read his blog at parkerhudson.com. Parker, welcome to The Reconnect.
Carmen, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
All right, you and I could talk about any number of things today. There's a blog post on your at parkerhudson.com that I definitely want to talk about who it is that we're representing in the world and whose ideas we're representing and how those ideas work themselves out. And we're going to talk about Darwin and Jesus. So can we just jump in right there?
Sure. Jump. Again, this is, you know, a potential 2-hour conversation, which obviously we're not having. So there are three. Let me say that the world believes that what Darwin said has been proven as scientific truth, and that what we say as believers is some sort of a fairy tale. And that's what most people, if you just stopped them on the street, would probably tell you. The truth is that none of this is proven science. And my main argument with people who are interested in this subject is, let's be honest and level the playing field and say that we really don't know how exactly either macroevolution, as they want to call it, occurs, or creation, as we call it, occurred, or that we obviously say that God did it. And let's have a conversation about it without it, the bias, the absolute bias that one is scientific and the other is gibberish. That's my biggest gripe. But when I'm talking to just average people on the street who aren't sort of embedded and haven't thought about this very much at all, there are really three different processes or events that we tend to sort of mix up. One is the creation of the universe and the earth. That's one. The second is how life could have formed on earth in some, you know, ungodly way, some purely scientific, quote-unquote, way. And the third is macroevolution, how one species evolves supposedly into another. And we tend to just swirl all those around in one discussion, which I think does us disservice and doesn't help our case. So I'm willing to talk about, with anybody, I'm willing to talk about any of those three topics. But I think the best one for us to focus on as believers is the latter one, just the pure Darwin theory of macroevolution. And the reason I say that is because it's just so impossible, and there's no proof of it, and it leads to a lot of interesting concepts about our life today. So I try to narrow the discussion down to just macroevolution.
Well, and when we narrow it down to that particular conversation, there are so many things that we can point to in the culture today. And everything from the question of race. Is there one race that's better than another race? Well, if macroevolution is true, if Darwin was right, And there is a difference in terms of evolution, in terms of pace, then racism is totally okay, and survival of the fittest is okay, and the superiority of men over women is okay. I mean, the list of social conversations that we can have out of the macroevolution conversation is a really important one. I think one of the things that fascinates me today, Parker, is the effort of people to extend human rights to animals, or I just read recently, extend human rights to the Colorado River. Actually to extend human rights to things that are clearly a part of the created order that is less than human, and to fail to extend human rights to human beings, including the 55 million people around the world who die in their mother's wombs by forced abortion. And so I'm sort of stunned that we're at this place in the culture, and yet I know we get here by Darwin. So can you just enter into that conversation however you want to?
Sure. And by the way, just to piggyback on that, obviously congratulations on your great new book, Speak the Truth. It's a fabulous book. And I love the quote that you have in from, I think it's Brad Bright, that where he tells African-American pastor that racism is perfectly fine unless the God of the Bible is alive and real. And that quote is so poignant, like almost everything in your book. It's a great book. So anybody listening who hasn't already gotten Carmen's book, she didn't expect me to say this, but you need to go get her book because it's a great book, Speak the Truth. But on the Darwin, you really hit the nail on the head, because now think about this. If people say that they believe in, quote, science, and they believe that Darwin proved evolution, as you were just saying, then think about this. The people accuse us of having somehow over the hundreds of years, thousands of years, somehow, although we didn't, sponsored or we were in favor of a patriarchal society, and women were subjected, and you know, we thought of colonialism and all this, and I'm not denying that in some places and sometimes that isn't true, but the irony is that, as you just said, that Darwin supposedly proved it scientifically. So if you're a progressive liberal secularist, then it isn't just that there's some idea that men are superior to women, or that the white race is superior to the black race. You have to understand that it's your man, Darwin, whom you say you believe in, who supposedly proved it scientifically, which then gave the foundation for everybody from Margaret Sanger to Adolf Hitler and a lot of others in between to take that argument to its sadly and tragic end, which is that it's okay to get rid of some people who aren't really quote-unquote people like us because they're either of a different race or they haven't been born yet, which is just insane. And yet that's where Darwin leads. So when someone tells me they believe in Darwinian evolution, I like to ask the questions about the subjects we've just been mentioning and see where they eventually get off the train, if they ever do.
Well, in my experience, they actually just like to get things on the train. Like they try to, right? So the effort is always to add things into the conversation that keep it from actually going down the track to the logical, tragic conclusion where Darwinianism naturally leads. So I've got a friend at Yale who is a secular humanist, and yet he likes to get the things about Jesus that he likes on the train. And so how do we confront that? How do we address that? How do we say, now look, you can't just borrow those things from Christianity that you like and value without actually accepting the God of Christianity and her Christ?
Well, I like, when it comes to Darwin, to just go back to the actual basics of what he said, because it's like, you know, his personal testimony, my personal testimony, yours, you know, what it's hard to argue with someone's personal testimony. And happily, Darwin wrote a lot. And there, in his own words, are statements that I think are worthy of repeating to people. It's not his fault, but at his time, any cell was thought of as just as the smallest building block of creation. They had no way to look inside a cell like we can today and see that there's inside each cell, there's 6 feet of DNA, all precisely arranged, and that inside each of our human bodies, there's enough DNA. If you trailed it all edge to edge, it would go to the sun and back 100 times in each human being. And so Darwin, it's not that Darwin is somehow at fault for this. He didn't know it, but people today are at fault if they don't recognize it. And Darwin said things like, you know, we will find in the next 100 years, he was writing in the 1850s, surely in the next 100 years, we will find all of the in-between, all the skeletal remains of all the in-between species that I am postulating that are between a this and a that. And if we don't find them, then my theory is wrong. And we haven't found them. There is not anything that's sort of half a bird. The idea of the of how an eye or a wing would work if it was halfway made just is preposterous on its face. So there are foundational problems with Darwin that you can talk about, which isn't just my opinion versus your opinion. You're actually quoting the man. And then you get to the ones that are the great ones where he says, in essence, in his book, The Descent of Man, that he says just straight out that men as a group are superior to women and white people are superior to black people. So just using his own words, I think, is one way to start to undermine people's just knee-jerk belief that somehow he's a great scientist that we're all supposed to believe in and fall in line behind.
Well, I'll go out on a limb that I know is incredibly safe, and I would say back to Darwin, if in the next 100 years you find the body of Jesus, I will let you prove me wrong. Right? I mean, he was going to rely on being proven right by the finding of fossils. And in 2,000 years, nobody's been able to find the physical evidence to prove the resurrection of Jesus Christ didn't happen. And so I do think there are compelling conversations for us to have with those of a secular mindset. But you are a good reminder, Parker Hudson, that we have to be students of those with whom we disagree. So you've become a student of Darwin. Like, you know a lot about what he wrote and what he said, and that more fully equips you to engage in the conversations of the day related to everything from politics to economics to healthcare to science and certainly to the things of the faith. So friends, again, you ought to check out his blog at parkerhudson.com. If you are a person who likes to read fiction that is frighteningly true, I commend The President, Enemy in the Room, and On the Edge to you. 10 Lies and 10 Truths is the kind of conversation that Parker and I have been having today, just in terms of directly addressing through conversational apologetics the issues that arise in our scientism-fascinated culture. So, Parker, thank you again for the nice things that you've said about my book, and thank you so much for your friendship and collegiality in this world that's so confused, but I just appreciate the clarity with which you speak the truth.
Well, God bless you and your book, and if people want the most succinct thing I can say is go read the first chapter of 10 Lies and 10 Truths, because this is the greatest lie you've hit. If people can believe Darwin, then they don't have to go anywhere else, because they don't have to be confronted with the possibility of a creator. It's Satan's greatest lie. That's why I made it the first chapter of the book, 10 Lies and 10 Truths. And at the end of the chapter, as you mentioned, there are resources people can go click and look and see, easily findable and not difficult to read information, because I understand it, that'll help them when they have these kind of discussions. And as you say in your book, and you say on your show every day, this is what we need to be doing to engage people with facts and the truth.
Hey, Parker Hudson, thank you so much. Everybody, you can visit him at parkerhudson.com. All right, friends, it's that time in the show where we go below the fold, where we lift up a story and make a connection that's designed to either help you start or engage in a conversation in the culture that at first maybe doesn't appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles can help you turn the conversation, right? You're going to be able to introduce some eternal principles and ideas that are going to get people thinking about what they're thinking about and maybe get them thinking differently about what they're thinking about. This is the get God back into the conversation part of the conversation. Okay, so here is my below the fold headline of the day from a source that I do not turn to often, which I have to scan and see where I got this. I'm pretty sure, because this came off of a website that is totally dedicated to what I would describe as like geeks. I don't know how else to say it. And so it's like Circuit. I'm probably not going to, it won't come to me, but I'll look it up for you. It's by Mark Harris. And he writes for Back Channel. And the article is called God is a Bot. B-O-T. God is a Bot. And Anthony Lewandowski is his messenger. So here's the lead. Many people in Silicon Valley believe in singularity, the day in our near future when computers will surpass humans in intelligence and kick off a feedback loop of unfathomable change. So they're actually in Silicon Valley looking forward to this, looking forward to this moment of singularity, at which point in time human beings will be surpassed in intelligence by computers. Now, what we're talking about here is not just computers like the one you're holding in your hand that you call a smartphone. We're talking about some super smarty pants computers that actually have what's called artificial intelligence. They actually have begun thinking for themselves. You say to yourself, well, I don't really need to worry about those kinds of things. Well, yes, you do. Because artificial intelligence is actually what is producing right now much of the conversation surrounding like Russian interference in the U.S. 2016 election process and cycle. We're not just talking here about people sitting at computers crafting tweets or Facebook ads. We're actually talking about robots with artificial intelligence knowing more about the American psyche and what divides Americans and what gets us agitated, and that they know more about that than we do. In fact, they know more about it than Facebook and Twitter. And so they can actually flood our system with all kinds of, well, naughty ads that we bought, by the way, that we bought hook, line, and sinker. It was the whole fake news process. Okay, so here's why I'm bringing this up today. Because Anthony Lewandowski is a multimillionaire engineer. He's at the heart of the patent and trade secret lawsuit between Uber and Waymo. Waymo is Google's self-driving car company. So here's why you need to know about this guy. He has a lot of money. He's really young. He's really smart. And he has founded a religious organization called Way of the Future. Now, Way of the Future is nothing less than a false religion. Here is the quote that he developed to promote the realization of a Godhead based on artificial intelligence. So this is the God is a Bot part of the article. Lewandowski is Way of the Future's CEO and president, which I know you're thinking to yourself, I thought it was a church, and normally those have pastors, but this is not really a church so much as a religious organization and movement that believes that an artificial intelligence Godhead can be realized. It aims, quote, through understanding and worship of the AI Godhead to contribute to the betterment of society. And they intend for this AI to have an, quote, earthly incarnation. I just want you to just settle in on that language for a moment. I just want you to settle in on the idea that that we have this Silicon Valley multimillionaire engineer who is obviously a genius, who for whatever reason thinks he needs a religious organization, thinks he needs a God. Let's just think about that part for a moment. This is you know, in terms of like Silicon Valley, this guy has like reached the pinnacle of success, and yet at the pinnacle, he wants a God above him. Even if it's a God he has to gin up through artificial intelligence. What does that say about the very, very deep human need for God. I mean, what does it say that there's a soul ache in the heart of the... And what does it say that we want a God so badly that we're happy to try to make one? Friends, you can make a God out of anything. People have been making gods out of a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, people used to make gods out of all kinds of things, right? I mean, there's silver, there's gods fashioned from silver. You remember a golden calf was once fashioned as a god. People fashioned totem poles as gods. People fashioned gods out of all kinds of things. People fashioned gods out of the bones of dead ancestors. I mean, there's plenty of worshiping the creature instead of the creator and worshiping things that are lesser gods than God. But here's the reality. The only one true God is the one who created all things, not one whom we can create, not even through AI. And so Anthony Lewandowski is going to be tremendously disappointed if and when he is ever at the point where he can realize and achieve the creation of this AI Godhead. He's going to be disappointed to find that that's in fact not God. If we created it, it's not God, because that works in reverse. Now, I suspect that what Mr. Lewandowski would then come back and say is, oh, but Carmen, the Godhead based on AI will be a creative God. It will be self-determining. It will be it will be generative. It will be creative. It will come up with things that we would have never dreamed or imagined. Well, it will still be the product of human engineering. What it is capable of doing will still be the product of what humans did, making who the God? Who's the God? If the creation is worshipped as the God, then it's whoever created the creation that's really the God. Which in this case, if it's human beings that created these AI computers, then it's the human who gets to be the God. Which, by the way, we are utterly insufficient to live up to that kind of calling or task. It's super curious to me that one of the things that they're definitely hoping for is that this AI would have a, quote, earthly incarnation. What exactly does that mean? How in fact would you have the earthly incarnation of a godhead of artificial intelligence? I mean, I maybe one of you out there knows the answer to that question, and if so, you can text me at 877-655-6755. Again, if you got the answer to how is it that we would have a, quote, earthly incarnation of a God created through AI, if you know the answer to that question, text it to me at 877-655-6755. Friends, again, this is idolatry. There's just really, I mean, it's the most old-fashioned of realities. It's the reality that we really don't want to worship God as God. And so we want to create a God in our own image in some way, shape, or form. And in this case, we want to create a God who we actually think can outthink us and outcreate us and outperform us and certainly outlive us. Which, if you follow the conversations out of Silicon Valley about singularity, ultimately that's the conversation that we're going to have. This day in the near future when computers will surpass humans in intelligence and kick off a feedback loop of unfathomable change, well, that unfathomable change is change that probably eventually does not include human beings at all. So if you want to consider a future without humanity, Silicon Valley is happy to help you do that through a God of AI. I, however, am interested in you reconnecting the eternal with the everyday with the real God, the God of the universe, the God of your own heart and soul. All right, visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast. Donate to the ministry. Share today's show with someone new. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.